special criminal tribunals and the ICJ in cases involving the 1994 Rwandan genocide, the 1995 Srebrenica massacre committed by Serbian militias against 8,000 Bosnian men and boys, and Myanmar, Israel will be much harder to nail. Unlike Rwandan, Hutu, Serbian, and Myanmar military chiefs, Israel has fast friends in Washington, Ottawa, London, Brussels, and Berlin. I spoke about South Africa's genocide case against Israel with a leading genocide scholar. William Schabas is a professor of international law at Middlesex University in the UK and professor of international humanitarian law and human rights at Leiden University in the Netherlands. Schabas is a Canadian. I reached him in Paris. South Africa's application to the International Court of Justice alleging acts of Israeli genocide against the people of Gaza, incredibly thorough, it's 84 pages, goes way beyond what I gather is really required to petition the ICJ for a provisional measures order.
Well, you know, they worked hard on it and have prepared as strong a case as they can for the purpose of the application, but it is true that the application at the International Court of Justice is just the opening salvo, and there's not the expectation that a country sets out all of its evidence and its whole case in the application. That's something that comes later, probably 6 to 8 months from now. The court will set the date, and they'll require South Africa to make its full submission. So for the purpose of the upcoming event, which is the hearing on Thursday and Friday, 11th and 12th of January, that will lead to an order, I think, on provisional measures within 2 to 3 weeks' time. And I think for those purposes, it's a pretty good, strong case. And I think that South Africa should be reasonably successful. They have a long list of requests, and I think it would be unusual if they were to get them all, but they'll get some of them for certain. And so they'll score an initial victory. Then at some point within about 2 years or so, there will be a debate on exceptions to jurisdiction. There will be objections by Israel to jurisdiction and admissibility. And that will be, there'll be, you know, that's hard to predict the outcome of that, but there will be a debate on that and there'll be a hearing. And that sometimes brings an end to a case and sometimes not. Then if the case survives that initial challenge, then it will go to what we call the merits. That's the core of the case. The allegations of genocide will then be adjudicated by the court. That's likely to happen in perhaps 4 years' time. It's hard now to predict this for a couple of reasons. First is South Africa hasn't set out its full case. Israel hasn't given us its answer and the arguments that it will have. And the other thing is that the law of genocide is a moving target. We had two judgments on it from 15 and 9 years ago of the International Court of Justice in cases from the former Yugoslavia, and they set out quite a narrow definition of genocide. But there's another case now that's working its way through the system, the Myanmar case.
The Gambia versus Myanmar.
Correct. And there are calls there for taking a more expansive view of the definition of genocide, and that will come from the Gambia. That's being supported by other governments. So a number of Western governments, including Canada and the Netherlands, and I think Germany and others, have made a submission in the Gambia-Myanmar case only 2 months ago, calling for a more expansive approach to genocide.
What's the difference between the narrow approach and the expansive approach?
The core of the difference is how you treat measures of population displacement and expulsion, what is sometimes called in a colloquial sense, ethnic cleansing. That was the core of the debate in the Yugoslavia cases. And the court basically ruled against the idea that that fit within the definition of genocide. But in the Myanmar case is very largely one of ethnic cleansing, of driving people out of a territory. And in the case of Gaza, it's also the core of the case is, I think, very largely about the displacement of the population within Gaza and the desire to expel the Palestinian population from Gaza, that the efforts are directed towards that objective rather than a simple military victory over Hamas, over the military operation of Hamas, which is what Israel sometimes says it's is the sole purpose of its military activity. So that's going to be what the debate will be about. And because the definition of genocide may be in flux, maybe, if it doesn't move, then things are likely to go better for Israel than if it does. And it's very difficult to anticipate how this will all go.
And the core of the definition of genocide, of course, is that there has to be dolus specialis. There has to be specific intent. It isn't sufficient to simply say Israel has indiscriminately targeted the population, killing large numbers of civilians, driving them out of their homes, inflicting conditions that would lead to starvation and disease, so on and so forth. You have to prove that Israel actually had the specific intent to destroy the Palestinian people as such, in whole or in part. And Israel denies that vociferously, of course.
That's right. It's always been difficult to establish, although it was established in the Rwanda tribunal consistently. It was established in a more limited way at the Yugoslavia tribunal with regard to the massacre at Srebrenica in July of 1995. That was upheld by the International Court of Justice in the decision between Bosnia and Serbia of 2007. So it's not impossible. It's just demanding, and we'll see where the evidence leads.
And this this joint declaration in mid-November by Canada, Denmark, France, Germany, Netherlands, and the UK that I think you were referring to, joint declaration of intention vis-a-vis Gambia, the Gambia versus Myanmar. And they argue here that acts committed against children can play an important role in determining specific intent. And given the significance of children to the survival of all groups, evidence of harm to children may contribute to an inference that the perpetrators intended to destroy a substantial part of the protected group. In South Africa's application to the court, there's just lots of information about the targeting not only of children, but of pregnant women. And there's a whole section devoted to Israel's intent to prevent births. So this seems, if the court accepted, I don't know if it did or didn't, this joint declaration, it would seem to be to build South Africa's case.
The declaration is certainly helpful to South Africa. Those countries, of course, are in general very close friends and supporters of Israel. And they didn't have Gaza in mind when they wrote that statement. And I suspect that many of the lawyers in the governments of those countries are regretting now that they set out those views, because they're going to be very hard for those countries to retreat from them. They said it's important for us to set out our views on genocide, and they've taken an expansive approach. So they're kind of stuck with that now, and they can't retreat from it. It's hard to measure the significance. It doesn't bind the court. And one has to be aware that those countries, too, were, you know, they are all genocide. The nature of it, the nature of the crime, means it gets weaponized a lot by countries. And they love to declare that genocide is taking place when it's not their friends who are doing it. So it's easy for Canada and Denmark and France and Germany to claim that genocide is being committed in Myanmar, or that it's being committed in China against the Uyghur. And we could give other examples. When it's the countries they don't like or that they want to embarrass or humiliate, then they will take a broader approach to the definition of genocide. When it's their friends, they'll say the opposite. So this is one of the features of this debate, which is, it's unlike anything else we have. I can't think of another issue in international law where we have this kind of a debate and a term that is so provocative and volatile. And where countries are, some of those countries have their own skeletons in the closet about genocide. And so this is what they can't predict. They open up as those countries did. You know, if they hadn't made that declaration in November, the British, the Canadians and the French and the Germans and the Dutch, they wouldn't be making it today. That's for sure.
And genocide is unique as a crime because it's invariably, by its very nature, it's preceded by all sorts of genocide talk, genocide language. We, of course, saw it in the 1930s in Germany, in Rwanda, well before the 1994 events, the genocide, and in the former Yugoslavia. And it's, of course, it's all visible in the occupied Palestinian territories, in Israel-Palestine. Genocide, the convention requires people to prevent it from happening. Like, stopping it after the fact is absurd. The idea, you've got to stop it before it happens. You've got to stop it when it's building.
Well, this is a distinct issue about the duty to prevent genocide. It's something that's not explained or developed in the Genocide Convention of 1948, and where the content of it has basically all been created by the judges at the International Court of Justice in the decision in the Bosnia versus Serbia case of 2007. And they developed this idea that there's a duty on states that's it's not symmetrical, because it doesn't apply to every state. It's not as if the obligation on the United States and Liechtenstein and Singapore is the same, because Liechtenstein and Singapore don't have any potential to have a significant influence on Israel, whereas the United States obviously has an oversized potential to influence Israel. And so the court said that it's all related to your ability, the strength of your ability to influence the government. So that points to the countries that are providing them with assistance and political support and so on, and they can make meaningful gestures of prevention.
I have before me this declaration that you drafted and signed in support of this preliminary injunction that's being sought at the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California by Defense for Children International and various Palestinian NGOs and individual plaintiffs. And in this, at the end, you write, I conclude that there is a serious risk of genocide committed against the Palestinian population of Gaza, and that the United States of America is in breach of its obligation under both the 1948 Genocide Convention, to which it is a party, as well as customary international law, to use its position of influence with Israel to prevent this genocide, unfolding genocide, from happening. Can you talk a bit about this?
Yeah, well, of course, for the reasons I explained, I think the law is quite clear that there is this obligation, and that the United States is, because of its role in Israel, Secretary Blinken's constant travels to and from Israel pretty much confirm this. He wouldn't be going there if they didn't have any influence in Israel, and he wouldn't be going there if it wasn't to exercise the influence over Israel. So the fact that the United States is really the quintessential state with influence is, I don't think, very difficult to establish. Then the other part of the claim is responding to the requirement that there be a serious risk of genocide. The main evidence at the time I wrote the opinion, back in, I guess, late October, early November, were the statements from Israel that they were going to cut off food, water, medical care, and electricity to the people of Gaza. And this was in, of course, a territory where there was no escape. There was no way of leaving the territory. So I think that clearly, there was a serious risk of the destruction, the physical destruction of the people of Gaza. I think what's become clearer now is that Israel, although it has claimed that the purpose of its military intervention in Gaza is to destroy the military threat that Hamas presents to them, that in reality, my impression is that they're not actually fighting Hamas they're not fighting very hard at all. And you can see this from the relatively low number of casualties they have.
And I've heard it. Somebody just said that it seems more like Hamas is the collateral damage. There's collateral damage being caused to Hamas while Israel targets the civilian population, all of whom are guilty.
That's right. If they were really going to wipe out Hamas, their soldiers would be going down into the tunnels and they'd be getting killed. And they don't want to do that. Is that because they're afraid, because they want to protect their soldiers, which is one possible explanation? But the more plausible one is that the real purpose of this whole exercise is to drive the Palestinians out of their homes and to make the life so unbearable for them that they will be receptive to fleeing the country, or they will eventually just be destroyed in one form or another. So I think that that risk, that the evidence that there's a serious risk of genocide is even greater, because we now have more evidence that enables us to identify the intent of Israel, which looks more and more like it's an intent to destroy the people of Palestine rather than an intent to defeat militarily the threat posed by Hamas.
And there's, of course, a much larger geographical and historical context to all this, isn't there? Historically, that all this has been going on for, well, one could say 100 years, certainly 75 years since the 1948 Nakba and moving forwards. And also geographically, that this is happening in the West Bank as well. And we can see all these actions taking place, many of them in the West Bank. Do you imagine the ICJ will take this seriously?
Yes, of course they will. I think that winning the argument that they are trying to remove Palestinian life from Gaza and from the West Bank will be that's a factual issue. And I think that South Africa will have a good chance of demonstrating that. Of course, that'll be some years in the future. So things are going to happen in the next few years that will in some way or another clarify that intent. So this is something that, the future is going to contribute to. But then the legal argument is whether driving a people completely out of a territory is the kind of destruction that the Genocide Convention requires. And this is the legal issue. And this will be the nub of the case, I would expect, if it goes to the merits, as I say, 4 years hence.
How quickly do you imagine the ICJ could issue a provisional measures order, if indeed it does?
Oh, probably within 3 weeks. And they will issue an order. I mean, I say will. I'd be quite confident that South Africa will achieve some form of victory in the hearings on the provisional measures. I wouldn't expect they'll get the whole list that they've asked for. And when that happens, Israel will claim victory because they were able to beat off a few of the requests from South Africa. And South Africa will claim victory because they won some of them. And different people will have a different view of it. It will give legitimacy. I mean, I recently spoke with an Israeli journalist who was telling me about this message that's being put out in Israel for local consumption, really, about this being a blood libel, this sort of thing, as if this is just some sort of grotesque anti-Semitic incident. And I think that there's no doubt that's not a message that's going to sell very well at the International Court of Justice. And what the result of the hearing in the next couple of days and the provisional measures order, one thing about it is that it's going to legitimize the whole debate about whether this is genocide or not. And it will be impossible for Israel to just dismiss it as a blood libel.
And of course, the top of the list of South Africa's requested provisional measures is that the court order or instruct Israel to immediately suspend its military operations. I mean, that would be way more consequential than the court urging Israel to avoid committing genocide, or that it allow more humanitarian aid to come in.
That's right. And that's the hard one to get that. That'll be the hard one. They did make such an order against Russia in Ukraine, and Russia, of course, didn't abide by it. I think there are two other dimensions of this case that I don't know how much attention people have given to them, but one of them is that they usually make orders against both sides in these issues. If it's a conflict, they will order both sides to refrain from doing certain things, and that's part of the sort of peacemaking role that the International Court of Justice has. In this case, they can't make an order against the Palestinians and against Palestine because they're not a party to the proceedings. And there'd be no logic to making an order against South Africa because South Africa is not a state with a direct interest in this except for its global altruistic interest in opposing genocide. So that's one of the, that's a feature of this that's sort of quite different and interesting. And I guess the other thing about the order, as I say, these orders are, they have a symbolic importance, obviously. And I mean, if we go to the Myanmar case where the order was issued just about exactly 4 years ago, and the core of the order was to Myanmar not to commit genocide, to which Myanmar replied, well, we're not committing it, so that's fine. We can live with that order. I would expect there be some, be quite possible to get an order along the lines of dealing with the manifestations of hate speech, which South Africa has attracted, has devoted so much attention to. And the order will be, it will put pressure on Israel's friends and allies in a way we don't have that with the Myanmar case the same way, because Myanmar doesn't have very many friends or allies. Israel has lots of friends and allies, and they're powerful countries. But they're also countries who will not want to be dismissive of the International Court of Justice. They're committed to the International Court of Justice, and they consider it to be a fair, important judicial institution. So whatever it rules, Israel may find it, you know, for its own internal consumption, easy to be dismissive of a judgment. They'll just say, oh, that's the UN, anti-Semitic, United Nations, there they go again. But their friends are going to have a lot of trouble with that. And also because their friends are themselves involved in litigation at the International Court of Justice, Canada is not going to join Israel in saying, well, what about South Africa? What a bunch of hypocrites. Who are they to go and file a case? Because Canada and the Netherlands have taken a case against Syria on very much the same legal basis, the idea that they're doing it as an altruistic representative of the international, so-called international community. So this is going to put this ruling and this litigation makes it hard for their friends to support them and to go along with them. And that may influence their own behavior because they won't want to distance themselves too far from their friends either. So I think these are facets of this, which are very, it's a very interesting dynamic. You know, we're in unprecedented territory here. This is all new. And the idea of states filing cases against another state charging genocide or torture in the case of Canada and the Netherlands is pretty new. And the idea that states intervene in proceedings to support another state, the example being the Ukraine versus Russia case, where you have, I think, more than upwards of 40 countries who have made interventions in that case. All of them, you know, friends of Ukraine, Western European and so on countries. But nevertheless, that's another feature. And there's also this kind of interesting north-south divide here, because the genocide cases, Myanmar and this one, these are countries in the south doing it. You know, the court is, it's a global court. It has a significant number of judges from the south, and the countries of the south have shown a significant amount of trust in the International Court of Justice, which probably they don't show as much for in other parts of the other institutions of the United Nations, like the Security Council, for example, where they don't feel that they have any friends at all, or maybe barely. But they seem to be more willing to trust the court. And that's also an interesting feature. So this is a court that's being transformed.
Do you think that these proceedings will have or are having an impact on Karim Khan across town in Den Haag in terms of his own seemingly quiescent pursuit of his investigation?
I don't know. He might be relieved that nobody's looking at him now. They're all worried about the International Court of Justice. So maybe he's just happy to have the pressure off him. And the problem, of course, that the fact is that countries like South Africa went to the International Court of Justice because they realize that they have more punch, they have more ability to do things than they do at the International Criminal Court, where they're frankly at the mercy of the whims and the discretion of a prosecutor who has his own perspectives on the world and seems to have one that's very much aligned with the countries of the North, Western countries. And that's politically where Karim Khan is aligned. And we don't have that at the International Court of Justice in the same way. We have some judges, obviously, who come from the Western countries and who will tend to be aligned with that sort of perspective on the world. But we have a number of judges from the South who have been quite outspoken and courageous. You know, this is another facet of the International Court of Justice, is that it's been historically, it's been a bit of a battleground between the North and the South. It's interesting also that this is all being done without the issue of Palestine's, which has been a question at the ICC, the issue of Palestine's existence as a state and as a state party. This suit, one of the interesting features is because it's filed by South Africa, it doesn't engage with the issue of whether Palestine is a state party to the Genocide Convention. Of course, it is on paper, but that wouldn't prevent Israel from arguing and debating the point before the court if it had been a case filed by Palestine. I know that some months ago, people were saying Palestine should take Israel to the International Court of Justice, and maybe that was a good idea, but there, Palestine is very concerned about the advisory opinion proceedings, which are going to be at the court in the coming weeks. And I think that understandably, they might feel that it's too much to be fighting two battles there at the court. And so it's a great initiative from South Africa.
Do you anticipate the court coming out with a more powerful advisory opinion following the mid-February hearings that are taking place over the course of a week as a result of these genocide charges that they already have heard?
I don't know if the fact that there's this other, the case now, the South African case, is going to be decisive, but there's no doubt that the conflict that began in October of 2023 is dramatically changing the reality of the debate that's going to take place in February about the advisory opinion. I don't know how much this case under the Genocide Convention, how significant that will be in influencing it. It's hard to tell.
But it may well lead to a resolution at the Security Council, ultimately calling for a ceasefire.
Anything's possible. You know, the problem at the Security Council is, as you know, you can get 14 votes for a ceasefire in the Security Council, but that's not enough. So I don't know how influential this will be with the United States.
I mean, it would be pretty shameful for the United States to veto or water down yet another ceasefire resolution in the wake of a provisional measures order from the ICJ, essentially acknowledging that genocide is plausible in Gaza.
I don't know. I don't know that they know the emotion of shame in the United States. You say it would be pretty shameful. Wouldn't be the first time they've done something pretty shameful. I think they can live with that.
Bill Chabas, thank you so much for your time.
Okay. Nice to talk to you, David.
William Chabas is a professor of international law at Middlesex University and professor of international humanitarian law and human rights at Leiden University. Read more about South Africa's genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.